Chapter 14. According to the Org, they were somewhere over the equatorial highlands of Syrtis Major, on the other side of Mars from Pavonis Mons. They had gone down in the cheapest kind of cut-price shuttle. Sunday had no regrets about taking the fast way. She was too excited for that. Jitendra shared her anticipation, his grin only intensifying as re-entry commenced. They'd gone from Stickney's centrifugal gravity to the freefall of the shuttle, and now weight was returning as the shuttle hit atmosphere and enveloped itself in a blistering cocoon of neon-pink plasma. As the deceleration peaked, the seats adjusted to provide full body support. It was more gravity than Sunday had experienced in years. She loved watching the plasma snap and ripple around the hull like a flag in a stiff breeze. And then it eased, and they were flying as much as falling. The shuttle's hull was reshaping itself all the while, optimizing to the changing conditions, resisting gravity to the last instant. Gullies and craters slid underneath, sharp-shadowed. Sunday, certain that she could stretch out her hand and feel the leathery texture of the surface, scraping beneath her palm like the cover of an old book. So far, at least, there was nothing down there to suggest that they were anything other than the very first people to reach this world. No settlements, no roads, not even a glint of some long-abandoned mechanical envoy, dust-bound for centuries. It was staggering, all that emptiness. Jitendra saw something, pointing excitedly at a dark, worming trail, the furiously gyring knot at its head, etching a meandering track across the surface. It's a vehicle, I think. A Mars rover, or maybe some kind of low-altitude aircraft. Sunday had already voked the mag to maximum. Kicking up a lot of dust. Moving pretty quickly, too. It's a dust devil, Eunice said, cutting into Sunday's thoughts. Just a whirlwind. She turned to Jitendra and repeated Eunice's words. Oh, he said, on a falling note. Raised on the moon, Eunice said disapprovingly. Doesn't have the foggiest notion of terrestrial planet weather systems. Sunday voked. Didn't think you'd show up until we were down, Eunice. There's local org, enough of a network for me to utilize. I'm syncing with my Earthside self as we speak. That's going to take some time. Have you heard from your brother? We talked just before I got on the shuttle. He knows I'm okay. Sunday still had one eye on the scrolling view. Have you been in contact with him?
Not since he went off-grid.
Sunday tensed.
What do you mean, off-grid? Your brother's currently a guest of the United Aquatic Nations in Tiamat. Truro sent a plane to pick him up.
I wasn't expecting him to let us forget the favors we owe him for. The only reason I'm here is because the Pans took care of my ticket.
They're more interested in us than I expected, though. This isn't just about reciprocity. I worry that it's me they're really after. You don't exist. And at the risk of wounding your ego, not everyone in the known universe is obsessed with you and your secret history.
Let's be honest, though. A fair few are.
But only because you spent half your life turning yourself into a puzzle.
Jeffrey blinked me a copy of the mural in your bedroom. Seems you were right about the alterations in Phobos.
Good to have my suspicions confirmed. I'm not infallible, and I can't vouch for the absolute reliability of my memories.
Trust me, I never once thought you were infallible. What do you know about Truro?
He's not top dog, although he's not far off it either. He answers to the Prime Pan, whoever that is. Here's the catch, though. Sift through my logged conversations, as I myself have done, and you'll find ample evidence of occasional traffic between myself and Tiamat. Highly quangled, so you can't get into deep content, but someone there was clearly of interest to me. For years, decades, going all the way back to Mercury.
You have a theory.
My death has stirred up ghosts, Sunday. I can't be certain of anything, but there aren't many people I'd have been capable of sustaining a lifelong association with, without one or both of us going mad with boredom. What I'm getting at is this. Did the Prime Pan know me? Did I know the Prime Pan? Tell me what you're thinking. Not yet. I'll wait for more data until I'm not only fully synced but back in touch with Jeffrey. Sunday seethed. I'm ordering you to tell me. And I'm refusing. This is a deep-level epistemological conflict, granddaughter. You can't force me to be more like myself and then throw a tantrum when I decide to act entirely in character. Live with your handiwork, my dear. You made me the high-minded bitch that I am.
It wasn't long before human presence asserted itself, in the form of what might have been a pipeline or power conduction conduit, lancing across the surface in bold tangents. A little later, as the line zagged to match their course, they passed over a frog-spawn clump of silvery domes, an outpost or some kind of maintenance complex. Even at full magnification, Sunday couldn't see a living soul. Then, 5 or 6 minutes later, the line met another trunk branching in from the north, and there was something like a village or hamlet at the junction. Multiple domes, square buildings, a geometric quilt of copper-green hexagons spreading to the south, solar collectors or perhaps crop beds, and a pale finger scratch arrowing west that was too purposefully Euclidean to be a dust devil track. She followed it, they were moving west as well, until she picked out a bumbling, bouncing form that was unmistakably a surface vehicle. It was the silver beetle with 6 huge wheels, plodding its way home. After that, signs of civilization only increased. More villages and then a town, domes laid out in curling galactic spirals from a central core. She couldn't see anyone moving around, even at full magnification, and when she tried to ching down to street level, her request was politely rebuffed. The town had a railway line, also punching west, slicing through some craters, angling around others, occasionally diving underground for no particular reason. Then she saw a train, speeding along the track in the opposite direction from their motion, 6 silver cylinders with surprisingly blunt, test-tube-shaped ends. They followed the railway line until it passed through another big town, and then a city twinkled on the western horizon. Cromelin Edge, said the org, and Sunday remembered that this was where they were going to be processed for final Martian immigration. The elevator's anchor point was halfway around Mars, so Cromelin Edge, located close to the equator, close to the zero meridian in the cratered plateau of Arabia Terra, was one of the 2 main entry points for arriving travelers. The shuttle made a pass over the city, sloughing altitude and speed. The settlement took the form of a crescent, partly tracing the outer wall of its namesake crater. Scant evidence of planning here, just a bubbling froth of variegated domes and other structures, cubes and rhomboids and cylinders, pylons and vanes, looking less like an organized settlement than a bag of marbles and toy building blocks spilt out onto the floor and gathered into rough formation. The artist in Sunday appreciated the ordered form of the spiral she had seen earlier, but there was something haphazardly human about this arrangement that also appealed to her. She liked her cities best when they contained gnarly, counterintuitive geometries. The shuttle came down on a landing strip surrounded by domes and soggy-looking amoeboid terminal buildings. The hull flicked to perfect transparency, and their seatbelts slithered away. Service vehicles were already surrounding the shuttle, while a docking tube extended itself into position, flexing and probing like the trunk of an inquisitive elephant. The sky over the spaceport was a darkening mauve, fretted with wisps of high-altitude clouds.
"Welcome to Mars," said a piped voice. "The Mars sol date is 102,447 sols. Local mean solar time is 18 hours and 31 minutes. For the benefit of passengers arriving from Earth, it is 16:35 coordinated universal time on March 13.
Cavernous and bright, the terminal could have been any shopping mall from Mombasa to the moon. Exos loitered to assist those struggling with the gravity, But no one was having any obvious difficulties. Adverts jostled for attention, pushing services and products that were, for the most part, uniquely Martian. Sunday wasn't at all surprised when she was taken aside for additional interviewing and background examination. They had reported the dead body on Phobos before boarding the shuttle and had been detained while bureaucratic procedure was observed. No crime had been committed. She'd been perfectly within her rights to trample all over the moon, and she'd broken no rules by chinging into the abandoned camp. Of necessity, they had to wait while Stickney authorities sent their own investigators into the sealed-up dome, verifying Sunday's side of the story. But once that was done, they were allowed to be on their way. Flags had been raised, though. It was difficult enough travelling incognito as an Echinya, but now there was the matter of the corpse and her panspermian affiliation. They were in the holding area when word came down from Phobos. The investigators had run a trace on the suit and cross-matched the DNA of the body inside with their records. The corpse belonged to Nicholas Escoffrey, a Martian citizen who'd gone missing on Phobos nearly 50 years earlier. Escoffrey was a broker in second-hand equipment, a wheeler and dealer who made frequent trips between the moon and the surface, and whose operations often skirted the edge of legality. At the time of his disappearance, Escoffrey was under investigation for customs irregularities, and appeared to have made efforts to conceal his true whereabouts. An area of Mars had been searched, but no one had guessed that he was actually on Phobos. "Wouldn't happen now," it was explained to Sunday. "You just can't get away with that kind of crap these days." How Escoffrey had died was a different matter. He hadn't been imprisoned in the camp, and the doors hadn't been sealed over until after his death. The best guess was that his suit had malfunctioned, its servo systems jamming into immobility, turning itself into a man-shaped coffin. Sunday remembered the white spider she had dislodged from Escoffrey's suit, though, and wasn't so sure, but she thought it advisable to say no more on the subject. They were eventually allowed on their way. As distasteful as the authorities found Sunday's panspermian association, it wasn't a sufficient pretext for denying her entry. All the same, she could sense the resentment that they hadn't found something to pin on either her or Jitendra. They collected their luggage, which was already waiting by the time they'd cleared immigration. Sunday made a conscious effort to put recent events behind her. She wasn't looking forward to what was ahead, and she could still see that paper-skinned skull grinning through her own visor. But that was over, and if she dwelt on it, it was going to ruin this delicious experience. Her first few steps on another world. She could return to this place 1,000 times, and it would never be this new. "We're here," she said, hugging Jitendra. "I can't believe it. Under my feet, it's Mars." Literally so. In the arrivals plaza, a strip of flooring had been cut back to raw Martian soil, like a lumpy red carpet. It must have been sprayed over with some atom-thin polymer to eliminate dust, but she could not have told that from the feel of the ground under her feet or the palm of her hand. For a ridiculous moment, she had to fight the urge to kneel down and kiss it. Jitendra finished rearranging the contents of the suitcases to make them easier to carry. "We need to celebrate. Get a drink now, before the moment passes." "So there's this amazing, precious experience, this once-in-a-lifetime thing, and before it has a chance to form deep neural connections, you want to batter it into submission with toxic chemicals?" Jitendra gave the matter due consideration.
"Basically, if you must put it that way, that's exactly what I had in mind."
"Fine," Sunday said, deciding that it was much easier to go along with him than otherwise. "I'm up for that as well." But first, there was some business to attend to. The Pans had given Sunday a Ching address to call upon her arrival. As tempting as it was to put the matter off, it would only be delaying the inevitable. She found a quiet corner of the arrivals lounge and voked the request. The bind went through with a high level of quangle, and she found herself in a room, which, judging by the high aspect of the sun, lay some distance west of Cromelin. Under her feet was glass, and under the glass was empty air, plunging all the way down to the scoured red ground, so far below that she might as well still have been in orbit. To either side, ancient, weathered cliffs receded into mist-hazed obscurity. A handful of sleek, discus-shaped buildings were cut into the cliff sides or buttressed out from them.
"Welcome, Sunday," she heard. "How was your journey?"
No complaints, apart from the friendly welcome at Cromelin.
"You'll have to excuse our customs and immigration staff. They preach courtesy and respect while demonstrating exactly the opposite."
Sunday took a nervous step sideways, distrusting the flooring. Even in Qing, it was hard to suppress vertigo or the instinctive urge for self-preservation. This was especially the case when the proxy was a living, breathing human organism. The warm blood belonged to a woman of about her age and build, although the skin was paler than her own. She wore a business outfit, color-coordinated skirt and blouse, dark green, offset with silver piping, black stockings, and sensible low-heeled black shoes. Sunday certainly wouldn't have trusted heels on that floor. She flexed the warm blood's fingers. She'd only chinged this way a couple of times before, but had already cultivated an intense loathing for the arrangement.
"Where am I?"
"The Pan outpost at Valles Marineris," the voice said. "We're on the very edge of the deepest canyon, the greatest rift valley anywhere in the solar system. I thought you might appreciate seeing the view through human eyes. My transform surgeon, Magdalena, consented to be driven."
"It's very thoughtful."
"Entirely appropriate, too. You're both sculptresses. You work with stone and clay, Magdalena with the living flesh. Now you are as one."
Sunday turned from the view of the Valles Marineris. A speaker faced her from a kind of bed, resting on an oblong of white, self-sterilizing front carpet. The bed was as heavy and complicated-looking as some ghastly iron lung or CAT scanner from the medical dark ages. It was plumbed into the wall behind, and it hummed and gurgled like an espresso machine. It was actually more like a bath than a bed, for the occupant was mostly immersed in fluid, contained by high-walled, slosh-proof sides. The treacle-thick fluid had a bluish chemical tint.
"Come closer," the patient said. "I won't bite. Biting is one of the very many things not presently an option for me."
Two green-uniformed female nurses stood by the bedside, one with a surgical trolley, the other with a kind of pan-compliant clipboard and stylus computer. Without a word, they took their leave, striding like catwalk models, one of them pushing the trolley before her. A door in the rear of the room snicked open and shut like an iris. Sunday came closer. She couldn't smell anything through the Qing bind, but wondered if the fluid, or indeed the patient, had a strong odor.
"I am Holroyd," the voice said. "You mustn't be alarmed. I'm actually in no great distress, and despite appearances, I do not believe success to be completely ruled out. At least not yet."
There was a man in the fluid, but only just. Her first thought had been cactus. His form, what she could see of it, was covered with jagged, dark growths, erupting from every inch of his skin. They were glossy and leaf-like, sharp-edged, studded with barbs and thorns. His upper torso, his submerged limbs, his head and face, there was no part of him where the growths were not rampant. His eyes peered through tunnels of pruned back growth. She wondered how much of the world he could see.
"What happened to you, Mr. Holroyd?"
He did not sound in the least bit upset by the directness of her question.
"Hubris, I suppose, or impatience, or some combination of the two."
She couldn't see a mouth making the words.
"I was a genetic volunteer. A Pan, of course. An old friend of Truro's, too. Though I doubt we'll ever meet again. Our paths have taken us in very different directions. His to the oceans, mine to... well, this."
"Did Magdalena do this to you?"
"Magdalena was part of the team that, with my consent, proceeded with the genetic intervention. Now she is part of the team attempting to undo the effects of that intervention. A hand spined and spiked to the point of uselessness, like a cross between a mace and a gauntlet, emerged from the cloying fluid. There were wounds in the armor, pale, healed-over scars and white, seeping gashes. The intention was to change my body, to armor it to the point where, with only the minimum of additional life support measures, I could survive outside without a surface suit. Thermal insulation, pressure and moisture containment, they were within our grasp. I'd still need an air supply, of course, and there'd always be parts of Mars that would be unendurable, even for me, but it was worth attempting. A gesture of intent, if nothing else. A sign that we are here for good, that we'll do whatever we can to make this work. Even change our basic humanity. How did it go wrong? There are no catastrophes in science, Sunday, only lessons. I'd far rather live in a universe capable of producing monsters like me than one where we understood all the rules down to the last tedious footnote. I'm evidence that reality is still capable of tripping us up. As I said, I am not in pain. And recently, we have made, I won't call it progress, that's too big a word, but there have been intimations, hints, of the possibility of a modest therapeutic breakthrough. The game is not yet lost. I hope things work out for you, Mr. Holroyd. I try to look on the bright side. That's vital, don't you think? The hand and arm sank beneath the surface of the fluid. The bed made a decisive clicking noise, and the fluid began to bubble vigorously. Well, to business, I suppose. And you'll excuse the abrupt shift in tone, I hope. I'm delighted you've made it to Mars, and you have my assurance that the initiative will do all in its power to facilitate your inquiries. You will spend the next 2 nights in Cromelin Edge, and I hope you'll take the time to see something of the city and the crater. Get your Mars legs. After that, we've arranged transportation to Pavonis Mons, or as close as we can reasonably take you. We will, of course, assist with any further logistical requirements that might arise, within the limits of funds and resources, of course. I hardly need add that there must be some reciprocity, however crass that sounds.
I understand, Mr. Holroyd. I wouldn't have been able to get to Mars without Pan sponsorship. I agreed to take on some commissions, and I'm ready and willing to fulfill that commitment.
Very good, Sunday. I've been looking at some of your work. Did you know?
I didn't, sir.
I'm no expert, but I like what I see. There are visible and public ways that you can help the initiative, and we'll come to those in due course. But to begin with, I wonder if we might consider a more personal study as a kind of warm-up exercise. I'm open to ideas. I never doubted it, but you may not... Holroyd faltered. I appreciate that this may not be easy for you, but I wonder if you'd consider a piece that drew its inspiration from me.
As you were, sir, or as you are meant to be?
No, Holroyd corrected gently. As I am, here and now, in all my splendid ugliness, a monument to ignorance and possibility. Hubris and hope. There. I've already given you a title. How can you possibly say no? Sunday had never felt less enthusiastic about a commission or less bothered about the title.
I don't suppose I can, sir.
The door opened and one of the green-uniformed nurses came back in with a trolley. Gleaming chrome instruments rested on it, including something that looked very much like a pair of pruning shears. I really need that drink now, Sunday said when she'd come out of Ching. Difficult client?
A prickly customer.
They found a bar called the Red Menace on the edge of a glassed-over mall filled with high-end boutiques and expensive souvenir shops. The Red Menace's stock in trade was bad-taste Martian invasion kitsch, from the slime-green cocktails to the skull-masked bartenders
and clanking steam-actuated Wellesian tripods that brought the drinks, clutching glasses in their tentacles and carrying bar snacks in baskets tucked under their bodies. Heat rays pulsed through puffs of dry ice, while portentous military music throbbed from underfloor bass speakers. Sunday should have been appalled, but in fact the bar suited her mood exactly. She was just wiping salt off the rim of her second silver locust, Jitendra was on his third, when she became aware that someone was looking at them from the entrance, standing very still and peering through the scudding gouts of dry ice clouding the bar. Studying the tall, black-skinned man, a sense of profound wrongness washed over her in a clammy wave, as if her every waking assumption had just been annihilated. The shock stole her breath. The universe appeared to stall, stretching a moment into a lifetime. The shape of his face, the light on the cheekbones, the wide, imperial brow, was one of the cousins. She touched Jitendra's hand, and although the effort was almost unbearable, forced herself to breathe and then to speak. Look. Jitendra looked at the man and put down his drink. With a calm that felt far out of place, he said, It's not a person. She turned up her own org threshold, letting the tag inform her that the figure was a golem. Hello, it said, arriving at their table. I'm glad you made it here safely. Do you mind if I take a seat? The golem tilted its face towards the third chair, the one nobody was sitting in. What do you want with us? Sunday asked. The golem lowered itself into the seat. I am Lucas Akinia's designated legal presence on Mars. It's autonomous, Jitendra whispered. Do you think it was here all along, or came with us on the same ship?
Who knows? Hector and Lucas probably have thousands of the fucking things all over the space system, ready to pop up like a slice of toast whenever they need a legal presence.
She glared at it.
I'll ask you again, what do you want with us?
This visit of yours, the golem said, has raised a number of flags. We've spoken to Jeffrey. Keeping secrets is not one of his core skills. She could see the trap she was being steered into, of disclosing more than she needed to.
And what secrets would those be?
The golem was keeping its voice very low, smiling all the while. You claim to be here on panspermian business.
I don't claim anything.
How would you characterize your ongoing business relationship with these people?
I am an artist. The pans need art to get their ideas across. Doesn't mean I bought the t-shirt.
The golem paused. Its cleverness was paper thin. It could emit statements and responses that sounded plausible, but the swerves and hairpins of normal human conversation left it befuddled. His visit to Mars comes hard on the heels of your brother's visit to the moon. Even the most casual observer might reasonably posit a causative link between the two developments.
Conclude what you like. Not my problem.
Jeffrey was tasked to investigate a matter on behalf of the family. Whatever he may have told you, visiting you was not the sole purpose of his trip.
In which case, you've just made a big fucking mistake in mentioning it now, haven't you?
The golem's face became a death mask, pulled too tight. There is something else, it continued after a pause. An incident on the Chinese lunar border and a demonstrable panspermian connection. Your associate, Charmer, was arrested and then released under terms of restraint.
It was nothing to do with me.
The incident took place near Eunice's crash site. The golem leaned forward and spoke with particular intensity. What did Jeffrey find in the Central African Bank, apart from the glove which we know about?
I've no idea.
It behoves you to show responsibility, Sunday. In these times of economic uncertainty, the continued good standing of the Akinia name must be paramount in our concerns.
Good standing.
She was thinking back to her treatment at immigration.
They hate our name, even here. You think I give a damn about preserving that?
Again, the golem appeared unsure how to respond. Akinia space is a building block, it declared. Thousands depend upon us directly for employment and welfare. Millions indirectly through secondary contracts and business transactions,
billions more by dint of our mere existence. Our machines bring valuable raw materials from across the system, from the main belt to the trans-Neptunian asteroids. Without that dependable flow, the entire infrastructure of human settlement and colonization would falter.
I'm not trying to bring down human civilization, Lucas. That would imply that I give a shit about it.
Our concern is that Eunice may have had self-destructive impulses. We worry that whatever was in the box was a metaphorical time bomb planted under the family by a bitter, resentful old woman.
You don't believe that.
Please do not doubt the seriousness of my concerns or the lengths Hector and I will go to protect this family. Sunday sat in silence as if she was giving the golem's words due consideration. Only when a suitable interval had passed did she allow herself to start speaking.
Cousin, we're not in Africa anymore. This is not the household. We're on Mars now, a long way from home. I owe you nothing. This is my life, and I do what I want with it. I do not want to speak to you again while I'm here. I do not even want to see you again, so please leave us alone before I make exactly the kind of scene you'd really like to avoid.
This may not be Africa, the golem said, but nor is it the de-scrutinized zone. You're in the surveilled world now, Sunday. He moved to stand up, rising from the stool with the oiled precision of a periscope. And it runs on our rules, not yours.